This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years, and not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
What? Behind the Bastards? Oh my God, it's a podcast about the worst people in all of history with me, Robert Evans, the worst podcaster in all of history.
That's not fair.
You're right. There's
definitely worse.
And then, yeah, sure.
I can think of several.
I off top, there's definitely way worse.
That's good. I finally got you to praise me on air, Sophie. That was
You're
all
wonderful.
That was the long con.
I'm like, you're not the worst one. Congrats.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah. What pride praise.
Yeah. I really feel good. I'm definitely ahead of the guys at the Serial Vapists podcast.
Is that a podcast?
It was a podcast, Katie. It was one of the, back when we were all still working at Cracked, because the first podcast I listened to was like a hardcore history or something. I was like, oh, this is kind of neat. And I was just like fucking around. I think it was looking for Serial because people had told me Serial was a good podcast. Okay. And like underneath Serial popped up another podcast, the Serial Vapists. I've talked about this on air before, but it's like some guys who lived in like North Carolina and just like drove to local vape shops and reviewed them.
That's amazing. And reviewed a vape shop. Wow. That's
yeah.
So
it was
specific.
So funny.
That's so great. Also, Katie Stoll's here, everyone.
Hey, Katie Stoll. One of the best podcasters.
Agree. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, I wouldn't, but that's for my therapist and I to unpack. Thank you for the compliment.
Katie Stoll, you and I used to work together on a podcast that is currently legally condemned by 11 U.S. states. So while we get through the litigation, how was your deposition, by the way?
I'm not at liberty to say.
Oh, right. Of course.
But,
yeah.
Right. Fucking crushed it.
Yeah. Oh, good. Sanders really tore me apart on the stand. So that's nice to hear. Katie, how do you feel about yoga?
I am so glad you asked. I'm going to get some hate for this. I know it. Mm-hmm. Not a big fan.
Really?
Not a big fan of yoga. I know. You're so graceful.
I would have assumed.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. I do. My body lends itself to yoga. I've got open hips. Like mm-hmm. I can do all the positions and stuff. It frustrates me. Yoga does, which probably is a suggestion that I should do it. But holding a pose makes me angry. And somebody might say, maybe somebody we talk about today, that there's some energy moving through me, but it makes me angry.
When people say there's energy moving through you, fuck them.
It's like, fuck these guys. No, there's something about yoga that I always would go to it saying I should do this. And I dropped wow. that completely during the pandemic. I also have a little bit of an issue with how nobody there's all sorts of understanding. There's different types of yoga. But in LA, it's very much a yoga culture. Yes. And they're always selling something, and you got to wear your outfits and you all this stuff. You don't gotta, but you know. So I have a bad taste in my mouth with yoga currently. And
Katie,
we'll see
that is not going to change today, because we are talking this week about two different yoga conmen. I should say my part. I've done a decent amount of yoga in my life. I used to do it. I used to do it like every single week. Sometimes I'd do like a video. Sometimes I'd go to a class. When I lived in LA, I would do, you know, I did Bikram from time to time, who we will be talking about in our second episode this week. And I like it. Like, I don't like, as a general rule, I hate exercising around other people. It's part of why, like, as soon as I got a house, like, I built myself a gym. I don't do like yoga regularly, but like I do, like these days I do particularly like a lot of hollow bodies and planks, because I hurt my lower back in Iraq a couple of years back. And ever since then, like if I don't do a bunch of both of those things like every single week, like my back starts to fucking seize up on me. So I value like the health benefits you can get, which I think are undeniable, that there are like significant potential health benefits to yoga. It is probably worth noting that like you can also seriously hurt yourself doing it if you're not like careful. But all of that is kind of beside the point, because we're not talking about like the merits of yoga as exercise.
I can speak to that.
yeah. It can be great. We're talking about yoga as a thing that con men gravitate to, which should not be read as like us. We're not trying to cancel yoga if you like yoga.
Also, I just need to chime in again and say, like, yes, even though I started off with the rant about yoga, it is objectively beneficial, especially for depending on your body and your physique. Yeah. With anything you have to go to the
with
right
the caveats
class in the
that
right
all
place.
Exercise has. Yeah. Yeah.
But I, yeah.
So that's where we are. That's what we're talking about today. Again, I, one way or the other, we're going to take a lot of shit online for this stuff, but like, I do want to make it clear. We're not talking about like, we're not trying to like blow up yoga. We're not trying to like reveal the evil that's behind stretching and shit in a group of people. It's just that yoga, like everything else in American culture, lends itself to con men and cult leaders. It's not different than like politics or religion. Yeah. You know, this is just another thing that lends itself to con men and cultists. Yeah. And they're different kinds of con men and cultists. Yoga cult leaders are a special breed, and we're talking about two of them this week. When I was kind of figuring out how to put these episodes together, I kind of briefly flirted with giving like an overview of like the entire long history of yoga. But to be honest, like there's so much debate by people who study it about like how exactly to describe the evolution of yoga as a discipline. And I am not one of those historians. So I feel like I would fuck it up if I tried to go into too much detail about that. I am going to give, you know, what I think is kind of like the briefest accurate description of like what yoga was historically. Yoga
this
as
is the
we,
right approach for sure.
Yeah. Cause it is complicated.
Well, and also it's part of what's gross about it. When I talk about LA yoga culture is just people not understanding what they're talking about in terms of the history or like, the spiritual nature of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, continue.
Yeah. Well, because yoga as, you know, when people in LA who have like got their $400 Lululemon like outfits or whatever talk about yoga, that thing, right? The yoga that you will experience if you type yoga into Google Maps and walk into like the nearest store, right? That's like 100 years old, right? Mm-hmm. Arguably significantly less. Obviously, a number of the different kind of moves that you do, the different kind of stretches and stuff, are much older, and some of the concepts are much older. But like yoga as we kind of talk about it is a fairly new thing. Now, obviously, there's also a yoga that goes back much, much further. The earliest yoga teachings are kind of a mix of philosophy and like different sorts of breathing styles and kind of health rules. You can kind of compare some of them to sort of the, you know, in the Bible, the Old Testament, you've got these rules like don't eat, you know, cloven hoofed animals or whatever. Like it's kind of some stuff like that too. Alongside in one kind of branch of yoga, asanas or like postures, right? development of what became yoga probably started around like 1500 BC. A lot of it is like kind of like 1500 BC to 500 BC is sort of like the earliest period of yoga.
Wow.
I think generally agreed to be. Hey everyone, Robert here. Just wanted to clarify. If you look into this, a lot of people will talk about, you know, the origins of yoga dating back like 5,000 years, which is obviously a bit older than 1500 BC. You know, it depends on kind of what you're talking about. The term, you know, the word yoga is much less old than that. Broadly speaking, without kind of getting into or taking a side, because that's certainly not my place. It's worth looking. You can look at kind of yoga and all of the things that sort of around it and fed into it. While there's not really a clean start date, something that's broadly as old in its earliest origins as like Judaism, right? It's in that ballpark, at least.
I actually am surprised. That's so long ago.
It's so, but it would not be, it's nothing like, again, it's not like what you get right, when you walk right. into a store. It's like a series of different like meditation or like philosophical like yeah. discussions and
I really all sorts, shouldn't like, be surprised, but I was like, wow, yeah.
Yeah, it's not like stretching and stuff, right? It's much mm-hmm. it's like kind of a philosophical spiritual like set sure. of like teachings and stuff. Probably the most influential, and there's a bunch of different branches, right? So like if you were in, you know, Northeast India, right, talking about, and someone were to say around like 500 BC talk about yoga, they might mean something very different from somebody who's like, you know, in Bombay or whatever, mm-hmm. Mumbai. That's just like there were different sort of like branches or schools of yoga, and the school of yoga that was kind of most influential to what people in Los Angeles mean when they talk about yoga is called Hatha yoga, which was heavily influenced by Buddhism. Several of the earliest Hatha texts, which date from around 1000 AD or so, focus on the preservation of vital force. This is often embodied by semen or menstrual fluid, which was believed to like drip out of the body. So there's some like retention of like, you know, vital fluid stuff in there. Hatha yoga translates most directly to the yoga of violence or force. But the violence there does not mean like, it's not like beating people up or whatever. It's the forceful fusing of opposites, or at least that's how the book Hellbent by competitive yoga guy Benjamin Lohr, that's how he explains it. Quote, "The violence of the violent yoga comes primarily from the method used to achieve these results, the forceful fusing of opposites. It's an ideal embodied in the Sanskrit named Hatha, where Ha stands for the solar, masculine energies, and Tha for the lunar, feminine forces, and reiterated throughout all Hatha practice. But it is perhaps best appreciated by the Naths, which is like kind of the guys doing Hatha yoga, principal innovation, postures or bending the body into forms. Prior to the medieval rise of Hatha yoga, standing contortive postures simply did not exist in yoga. The word asana was present, however, it was used almost exclusively in the etymological sense, as seat or throne. The asana practices described in pre-Hatha yogic literature were meditative postures, firm and stable positions, thrones from which to contemplate existence." Right, so initially this the kind of asanas is referring to like this is how you sit while you're doing these meditations on these kind of spiritual things. In the medieval period when Hatha yoga, you know, becomes a branch of sort of the different sort of yogic disciplines or whatever, this expands from just sort of like a meditative posture to more something closer to what we would recognize if we walk into a yoga shop in LA, right? Now, Hatha yogis are kind of religious wild men, right? And this is a thing, this is a big thing in India, actually. You get like people kind of play acting like this in certain particularly like Pentecostal disciplines in the United States, but like India is a place I've spent a decent amount of time. When you're in certain cities, particularly, you'll see these like crowds of dudes called sadhus who are these like, I mean, they're effectively like kind of wild roving priests. They'll have these like long, like often like down to their feet, dreadlocks and beards that are like painted in these bright like orange colors. And they some of them engage in like these really like in public and stuff, these really like physically, like this is like the laying on beds of spikes kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah, yeah. The, these kind of like very demonstrative acts of like intense physical demonstrations and whatnot that are kind of showing their level of mastery and stuff that they have over their body or whatever. Like this is a concept that goes, that is kind of like very common all throughout different kind of Indian religious traditions. And the Hatha yogis were one of like the earlier examples of this. Their yoga included kind of what would sound to modern people like it includes kind of a peculiar variety of health acts. One of the things they would do was suck water up through their anuses to perform a self enema. Yeah, like self enemas are a thing. I mean,
no, I don't need to play that.
I don't know how to do that, Katie, but that's a thing they would do. They would like, they would teach that you
Katie,
can, if you drink
it. Katie, are you Googling it?
I almost did, but I didn't. Like, but I did put a mark down on my notepad to look at it later.
They would also do stuff like they would teach people that if you could drink the middle third of your urine stream, it would destroy diseases of the eyes or give you the ability to do clairvoyance. And this is actually not uncommon. There were a lot of different cultures where like some degree of drinking urine was something that people that was like a part of traditional medicine. And there's a number of Mesoamerican groups like mix urine with tobacco or whatever.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, it's like it's a thing. Yeah,
I was taken aback by did you say midstream? So it's not the beginning.
It's the middle of the stream. Yeah, the middle third.
Do you collect it or do you bend over and?
I should have looked that one up further, and I do apologize for you.
This is my bad. I don't need to get hung up on the specifics here.
As far as I can tell, you wouldn't go wildly amiss in kind of looking at this the way that most Americans look at like snake handlers in the Pentecostal tradition, where it's like, it's not like nobody follows these guys or like nobody thinks that these guys, you know, have something to them. And in fact, a decent number of people probably think, you know, these folks are right about a number of things, but they're also, they're kind of fringe, right? This is not the Hatha yogis are not like the most mainstream chunk of the yogic discipline. They're kind of seen as weirdos at the time by a lot of people, right?
The way you're, I can get that. Yeah.
Yeah. In the same way, like a lot of monks, you know, we're seeing traditionally is like, you know, maybe we think they're holy, but they're also a little odd, right? Yeah.
It's not that you're like disrespecting them. They're there, but it's not representative of how everybody is moving through the world.
Yeah, exactly. Hatha yogis engaged in acts of extreme religious aestheticism, like chaining themselves in place for days at a time or sleeping on beds of nails. They were often seen and kind of treated something like wizards in old medieval folklore, right? They're dangerous and they're generally to be avoided, but they also possess potent knowledge. And so maybe you'd go to one of these guys, maybe most of the time you would kind of want to keep your distance because they're weird and like kind of off-putting, but like you get like your kid gets sick or something, maybe you go to them hoping that they know something, right? Because they're seen as sort of possessing this knowledge that can be useful to people who are desperate. Now, when the British take over, the new Raj has no place for anything as strange or as uncontrollable as Hatha yoga. Its practitioners became outlaws, banned under a law restricting miscellaneous and disreputable vagrants, which is also an interesting, an accurate description of everyone we hire here at Cool Zone.
yeah, it is.
So,
interesting.
Yeah. And Cody, let's be fair.
I know. Yep. I was thinking that too. And our whole team, everybody.
Yeah. So yoga was much wider as a discipline than just Hatha. And many Hindu monks still embraced kind of different branches of what many of them. Yoga is often considered by these guys. They talk about it like it's a science, right? They consider it to be a science. Mm-hmm. And so I think it might be accurate to say that like, if you were to like talk to one of these yogis, you know, from like the 16, 17, 1800s and show them a bunch of like people doing modern day, what we call yoga in LA and be like, this is yoga. It would be like walking up to a scientist with an eighth grade biology textbook and being like, this book is science. Like, this is all science. Like this book is what science is. And like, well, no, that's one example of it. But like, there's a lot of other things involved in the discipline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also what we see is probably unrecognizable to them for sure.
Yeah. So in 1893, a Hindu monk who came to be known as Swami Vivekananda was born to a wealthy family in Calcutta, which was the capital of the British Raj. He became a disciple of a mystic, Ramakrishna, and took monastic vows right before his teacher passed on, which is kind of a story you hear a lot among these sort of like guru type guys. Is like they'll have this teacher, they'll follow them, and like when that teacher's on their deathbed, they'll make some sort of like vows and stuff in order to like carry on their work. Vivekananda traveled the country for 5 years before deciding it was his karma to go to the United States and spread an understanding of the Hindu faith. The best place to do that in 1893 was the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago. Back in the day, before we had TikTok and Twitter to teach us about foreigners and various kinds of grind set, people held massive fairs every few years to get an idea of what was happening in the world, right? That was your TikTok, show up in Chicago or New York. They'd build a bunch of like dangerous fire hazard buildings that looked pretty from a distance, and you'd look at some like Frenchman show you new cannons that were about to massacre people in Africa.
It's like a mashup of TikTok and Burning Man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, TikTok, TikTok, Burning Man, and like a Raytheon arms fair.
Yeah,
like, that's these expositions.
Honestly, this feels much healthier just to get it all done at once.
Yeah,
and then
just
go
do it all at once,
life.
But and then the rest of the time you don't have to deal with it. Yeah, You see Andrew Tate 1 week and then he dies in a structure fire. Like. Yeah. It's beautiful.
That's much more tolerable to me, but okay.
So these were basically early trade shows, except the industry was the human race. And as a result, the Columbian Exposition had a world's parliament of religions, which was an interfaith conference with the noble goal of making Americans less chauvinist about their weird brand of Protestantism. Now, a bit of a legend has grown up around this guy and this meeting at the World Parliament of Religions that says that he kind of announced to the crowd at the parliament that he considered them sisters and brothers of America, and he was met with rivers of applause, and he used this momentum from this meeting to go on this successful lecture tour where he sold a bunch of books, and he like spread Eastern mysticism all around the United States for the first time, and he even opened several branches of like a mission on U.S. soil. Pieces of this are true, but painting Vivekananda's speech as an unqualified success leaves a lot out, as this write-up by Philippe de Slip makes clear. The approval given to Vivekananda at the Parliament in Chicago was not unique to him, however. In the account of the Parliament published by its president, John Henry Barrows, applause was also freely given to the other speakers as part of the self-congratulatory spirit of the Parliament. And Vivekananda did not just receive praise at the Parliament. Barrows also noted that very little approval was shown to some of the sentiments expressed by Vivekananda in his closing address. Vivekananda's subsequent lecture tours drew curiosity and interest, but also some hostility. In a letter to one of his American students, in 1897, Swami Vivekananda described himself as a much reviled preacher in the United States. Which I don't think is surprising, right? That Americans would meet their first Hindu like religious leader and be racist, right? Like that's not shocking, you know?
I'm like, this seems to be expected here.
It's the 1890s.
I was more surprised with the idea that he was a raving success that immediately has a very successful book tour, lecture tour. I mean, I was like, wow, okay.
Yeah. Honestly, I'm kind of surprised nobody tried to assassinate him. Like that's better than I would have guessed from Americans in the 1890s.
Wait a minute. So he made it out of there alive?
He made it out of there alive. Oh. You know what? I might raise that flag up on my flagpole today. Yeah. America. Sometimes we're slightly less racist than you'd think. You know what else is less racist than you'd think, Katie?
What, Robert? I can't begin to
imagine.
The
products and services that support this podcast. Absolutely.
Obviously, Katie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. Sometimes, anyway.
Sometimes. The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild mini-games. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play. My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity you get. Wow, how have I been living like this? It's kind of like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless, when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. Wow, how have I been affording this? It's time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/behind. That's mintmobile.com/behind. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/behind. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah. Oh. Sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Ah, we're back. And yeah, better than ever. Or more or less the same as ever. Either way. So,
yeah.
Despite the predictable distaste that many Americans felt for him, Vivekananda's teachings on Indian religion and mysticism had a significant, I should say on the Hindu religion and mysticism, because it's, this is actually a big problem. Like a huge number of Indians are Muslim. I don't want to be, and also, you know, there's like not just Muslim and Hindu. I don't want to be like the Indian religion is Hinduism. That's a big problem today. But like he is talking specifically about like the Hindu religion, Hindu mysticism, and his teachings on that topic have a significant impact on what you might call early American seekers. Even at that period of time, there was widespread interest in the East and alternatives to kind of the same old Judeo-Christian claptrap that seemed to a lot of people in this period to be kind of dreary and lacking in avenues to pursue self-fulfillment, right? Part of what's happening in this period is that Christianity has not caught up to modernity, right? And so people are experiencing this rapid advance in science, but like they're still basically worshiping kind of in the same way they would have in the 1600s, 1700s, mm-hmm. and folks are like, well, this kind of seems boring as shit, right? Especially folks who are like, you know, upper middle class or wealthy, right? It's just not as exciting to those folks and to like intellectuals as this guy Vivekananda coming in and talking about this like weird new religion they've never heard anything about. Of particular interest to these early seekers was yoga. Now, Vivekananda was not a big believer in Hatha yoga, nor was he teaching asanas to like large groups of people. He's not leading like what, you know, again, what we would recognize in the modern term as like yoga sessions. But he did mention various practices that were part of yoga. Although at the time, there was kind of fairly little agreement about what yoga was. Vivekananda spoke about it mainly as a philosophy of self-improvement and often as dietary guidelines, too. I'm going to quote from Philippe again here. His published lectures in the United States are flooded with the word power, and in one of them he enjoins his listeners to stand as a rock, you are indestructible. Not unlike an immobile rock, Vivekananda's approach was devoid of the flowing sequences of asanas or postures that are now commonly associated with the practice. So, while he avoided talk of Hatha Yoga in public, he did speak more openly about it to his close followers. He admitted to them that in 1890 he'd gotten interested in it as a solution for his health, but had backed away from his studies after his master admonished him. To audiences, he called Hatha gymnastics and queer breathing exercises, but in private, over the years, he taught small groups of students a handful of different poses, right? So this was kind of a thing that maybe he was a little bit lukewarm on. There was some stuff he found interesting. So when he's got these more dedicated groups of practitioners, he'll walk them through some poses. He'll do probably the very first like yoga sessions, like in the United States. But in public, when he's doing his big speech, he doesn't really talk about this other than to kind of broadly mention like, oh yeah, and some people do this, you know? Vivekananda's time in the United States marks, according to religious studies lecturer Suzanne Newcomb, a turning point in how Indian religiosity was understood outside of India. In the decades to come, the profile of such teachings would be raised again by a wave of immigrants to the United States, many of whom came to work dangerous jobs on railroads. The government was loath to give them civil rights, and so many of them wound up itinerants, wandering around the country and dispensing spiritual advice because, like, what else are they going to do, right? Yeah, like, there's not a lot of gigs, you know? One prominent American writer in 1938 referred to these people as traveling salesmen, writing that every winter we can find advertisements of the appearances of yogis in the cities of the East, and during the spring and the summer, they work the back places. But by the end of the 1930s, a revival of hatha practices in India had brought a wider knowledge of the asanas to the United States. Gradually, many progressive Americans started to view yoga not as some sort of foreign magic, but as a physical exercise. And kind of that process is pretty steady over like a 20-year period or something like that. But there are some hiccups in it. And probably the biggest hiccup in like the road to yoga being seen as respectable is the life and career of an American named Pierre Arnold Bernard. He's probably the first man to get rich off of yoga in the United States. And of course, he is a white dude, right? It makes sense that the first guy to get fucking loaded from yoga in the U.S. is a white guy.
Yeah, absolutely. That's another thing that's absolutely not surprising at all. Disappointing. I had hope that Vivekananda was going to be the person who got rich and was a bastard, but that's not the way this is shaping.
I don't think he is. I don't think he was like broke from doing what he was doing, but he does not seem to have been like,
I don't actually wish that in any capacity, but unsurprising that this is the white man.
Enter the white man. Yeah, this is our first yoga grifter. Born Perry Baker in 1876,
he changed his name to Pierre?
Yeah, he sure did. He sure did. this is before 9/11. It was good to be French.
Okay. Thank you for noticing that, Katie.
Born Perry Baker, 1876, he meets his first yogi at age 13 in eastern Nebraska, which gives you an idea of like how many of these guys are kind of wandering around. Mm-hmm. Like a kid in 1899 East Nebraska meets like a wandering yogi, which paints again. We often think differently about America in the past than it would have been. I think that's kind of worth noting. So Perry had long been obsessed with spirituality and the occult. You know, we've talked about this in the Helena Blavatsky episodes. Jamie talks about this in her Ghost Church podcast. The end of the 1800s, early 1900s, there's this wave of spiritism, right? These like people are doing like channeling and they're talking to the dead, and you know, you've got all these kind of like magicians wandering around the country doing shows. The occult is really sort of taking off in popular culture. And as a kid, Perry's super into this stuff. So when he runs across this Syrian Indian yogi named Silvais Hamadi, who's a practitioner of Hatha yoga, he's down with what this guy is teaching. Now, I can't tell you if Silvais Hamadi was like a legitimate, for one thing, he's like, I can't like guarantee for you that this guy is in any way teaching legitimate yoga. It's the 1890s, you know, who knows what's going on here. But with Silvais, at least, his yoga includes what's described in the literature I read as magical sex rites that were acts of worship for the goddess Shakti. Perry gets on board with this shit, and kind of as a young man, he and his guru move to San Francisco, where Perry changes his name to Pierre. He starts teaching Hatha to interested seekers and charging an exorbitant price for the privilege, $100. That's like what it costs to get like initiated into his order so you can like do yoga with them, which that's is several so thousand dollars today. Like he is fucking charging. Like that's a lot of money today.
It's a lot of money to pay $25, $30 bucks for a yoga class.
Yeah. No, you're paying like the equivalent of several grand. Now, you're paying that to become like a member of this sort of yoga organization so you can come in and do like regular. Although I think you're often kind of like pushed to, you know, give donations beyond that, obviously. He's not targeting poor people, right?
No, why would he?
Yeah. Now, this is not a popular business to be in. San Francisco was not at this point a willing mecca for the weird, and Bernard was forced to flee with his few followers, who called themselves the Tantrics, with a K. You've heard of tantric, you know, yoga, yeah. They spell it T-A-N-T-R-I-K. In 1906, they moved from San Francisco to Seattle, which was also not yet strange enough to host them. And so 3 years later, after having picked up, and they're picking up people, he's picking up followers, like he's running like a little cult, and he's getting followers.
I was gonna say, it sounds a little culty.
Yeah, he picks some up in NorCal, he picks some up in Washington, and then they head east to New York City. Now, by this point, Bernard's followers are calling themselves the Tantric Order, and they, you know, with the kind of limited funds they have, because they're not doing great, they get buy a townhouse, which they decorate in mystic stylings and start to operate as a yoga school and a sanitarium. Now, the best book on Bernard is called The Great by Robert Love. And in that book, Love describes Bernard's early East Coast clientele as a mix of well-heeled, interested parties, doctors, patients, the sickly, occultists, spiritual seekers, and health fad enthusiasts. So, not a lot's changed.
I was going to say.
Yeah. Basically, like Santa Monica, folks. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
it's
the
New York City, right? Yeah.
Yeah. New York, honestly, New York hasn't changed a whole lot.
No. Yeah.
Quote, the Tantric Herald spread the news. There was a new guru in town. Come try our hatha yoga classes offered several times a week in the evenings, along with instruction in yogic breathing, meditation, and philosophy, or drop by on the weekends on bacchanid evenings when food and drink would be offered and the house was open to respectful, curious seekers. And, you know, he's mixing. The Tantrics are like not, again, this is not, you wouldn't, like, if you were to, like, bring some yogas over from India, they would have a lot of notes on what these guys are doing. The fact that they're doing, like, bacchanate evenings, which is, like, not, you know, Hindu, evidence of kind of, they're mixing and mashing a lot of stuff, but they're using kind of the branding of yoga because it's Eastern and mysterious, right? And it has, you have to think too here, yoga has a connotation that's more like if you talk about like magic today, again, like than like it does now. These people are not just thinking like, oh, I'm gonna go get like in better shape and improve my joint health, right? That's not why people get into yoga in this period of time.
No, it's probably more like going to your tarot person or
That's
not quite, but
yeah. Definitely closer than like, I'm going to go get healthy, you know, I'm going to get fit. Right. I'm going to get, you know, flexible. One of these early seekers was a woman named Zelia Hopp. She lived with her, which is a pretty cool name, by the way.
It's a really good one.
Yeah. She lived with her parents in the Bronx and had suffered from a series of ill-defined but serious physical ailments. Numerous doctors had failed to offer her any relief or long-term benefit. And she was ill enough. It's kind of unclear, like, what's wrong with her. It seems like it's one of those things where they just didn't have a diagnosis. It might have been just like maybe she had some sort of allergy that at the time, everything her parents were giving her, like, and they just didn't.
She couldn't eat gluten and she had no idea.
Yeah, exactly. Like, right. Yeah, we don't really know. But she's ill enough that her parents are terrified that she might suffer from the worst fate a woman can experience. Not being married to a dude.
Is it being single?
Yeah, it's being single. Well, she's a spinster. She's like 21, you know?
Oh my God. Kill me. Don't really.
So Zelia's got an older sister, Esther, who had heard the news about the Tantric's arrival in the Big Apple. And she told her parents that, like, hey, you know, there's these guys, this new order, they're doing this Eastern philosophy that's like got medical aspects to it. And I hear there's, their leader is this guy, Dr. Warren, who's a powerful healer who just come from Seattle. Now, Dr. Warren is Bernard. This was another name he went under. And, Pierre Bernard is not a doctor. Although I should note when I say that, most doctors in 1909 aren't really
doctors.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this is not as alarming as it normally is.
The qualification for doctor in the then was just deciding you are one.
Yeah.
But he changes his name. He's not even Pierre Bernard.
He's Dr. Warren. Yeah,
Dr.
right
Warren.
Now.
It's out of left field there.
Yeah. Yeah, at least in his like public facing stuff. So Pierre told them that he was like, they go to him to kind of get a consult and stuff. And Pierre's like, I'm an expert in curing neurasthenia, which is a heart condition that he said that she had. Now, Pierre, he knows more about medicine than the average person. He's not educated, but he's an autodidact. So he reads a lot of medical texts along with a lot of spiritual texts. And he's really good at like weaving all of this together and like mixing. Some of this is like legitimate, you know, yoga. Some of this is like different aspects of like Hindu or Buddhist beliefs that he's read. Some of this is like shit he picks up from medical textbooks. And some of it's like probably Blavatsky style, like occult, you know, whatever. And he's mm-hmm. he's pretty good at like mixing and mashing all of this together. And he really impresses the family in his first visit or in their first visit to him. But he still charges them like when after he gets their consult, they're like into what he's saying. But the price he quotes them to treat her is like outrageous. It starts with a $40 initiation fee, which is, you know, an average American at that point gets about $13 a week for about 59 hours of labor, right? So he's charging them almost 3 weeks of like yeah. full-time labor to get it initiated, right? And then there's ongoing charges after that.
Also doesn't sound that different from today.
No.
Counting for inflation.
Yeah, this is how a lot of like quack stuff still works, yeah. right? Where, yeah. We've talked about this in a bunch of different contexts. But her parents are able to put together the funds, even though it's a serious, like it is like a burden for them. And yeah. off Zelia goes. Robert Love writes about what happens next. The next day, with her parents' approval, Miss Hopp traveled alone to Manhattan and arrived at the Brownstone, where Bernard, cigar in hand, ushered her into a back room and conducted a physical exam. He concluded that yes, he could help her. Yes, she could regain her vitality and even flourish under his care, but it would take extreme measures and individual attention. He sent one of his associates to find a suitable place, and in November, he installed her in his new sanitarium, a rented apartment at 70 West 109th Street, near Central Park. Zelia's father visited the place to make sure it was on the up and up before allowing his daughter to move in. Beneath the cloak of therapy, however, a powerful attraction developed between the worldly 33-year-old Bernard and the 19-year-old Zelia. Her first night in the apartment, Bernard paid her a visit, and between boasts of his knowledge of spiritual domains, he kissed her until her breath gave out. She was a lucky woman, he told her. He was very powerful, very wealthy. He assured her of his commitment and his honorable intentions. She felt herself fall completely under his power, hypnotized to obey him. Several nights later, she surrendered to the most pressing of his wishes, and the couple made love. So, yeah, that's problematic, we could say. You know, he's supposed to be her doctor. She's living in a sanitarium that he runs.
Doesn't even make it one night.
You know, the age gap's a little bit problematic, too. Like, there's a lot that's problematic about this.
A lot that's problematic.
Yeah. Zelia becomes a live-in at the Tantric House, where the two make love on a regular basis until her family stops being able to pay for her treatments. At that point, she is kicked out of the sanitarium. But when she gets back home, she's apparently free of her heart condition. Like, she feels better. So, I don't know, maybe she just needed, like, I don't know, you know, like...
maybe she just needed to get fucked.
Who am I to say? So, for a while, her parents are like, well... it was worth it, right? Like, she's feeling better. You know, they don't know exactly what's happened, but they see that she seems to be in better health, and that's mostly what they care about. So for a while, everything's fine. But Zelia's turnaround had more to do with the fact that she'd fallen in love with Pierre than the healing power of whatever he was advertising as yoga. A modern person might have recognized that a dude who kicks you out because you can't afford the rent at his unlicensed hospital is not your soulmate. But these were more primitive times, and Lifetime original movies hadn't yet taught that message to people.
Yeah.
The business at the Tantric House continued to evolve. They developed an enrollment contract for potential students, which offered them either an upfront fee of $100 or three monthly installments of $40 each. For $20, Bernard would give you a physical examination, and for just $2, you could acquire your very own copy of their newsletter, the Journal of the Tantric Order. Yeah! Which I'd love to get a copy of if anyone runs into one out there.
Journal of the Tantric Order.
Yeah, that sounds good. Initiated students could attend yoga classes on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Pierre, an early trailblazer, realized that the best way to get repeat customers was to put the hot chicks in his flock up front and center. His best instructor then was Aura Ray, real name Gertrude, who wore, quote, yogi suits, skin-tight colored tights covered in tantric symbols that were basically the only attractive clothing that anyone wore in a this is like the early 1900s, right? Yeah. Everybody is like, yeah.
This is prototype Lululemon, right?
Exactly. He's a trailblazer. Yeah.
I have him to blame for the yoga outfits.
Yeah. Yeah. He is the guy who's like, well, if we just like get attractive people to wear yoga pants, we can get all sorts of folks to just come in and hang around, right? This is how we make money, you know?
Oh my God.
So Love writes that many of their customers were, quote, older men in search of rejuvenation, mm-hmm. which often came from young women teaching them to stand on their head and making strategic physical contact to guide them in the asanas. These older men were often comparatively well off, which was required to afford the blistering fees Pierre charged. He appeared only sparingly in classes to lecture his students on spiritual matters and give them his own esoteric advice on health and diet. Zelia continued to visit whenever she could, and over time she grew concerned and suspicious about how many of his followers were attractive young women. She was also frustrated. She was also frustrated by the fact that he kept sections of the townhouse off limits to her for obvious reasons.
Okay, so are they still dating in some capacity here? Is he charging her?
She would say they're dating. Pierre would say they are not dating, right? Like, I think that's
Pierre
kind
be
of
like, that chick just won't leave me alone.
I'm teaching her, right? Like, she's a student. Yeah. You know, I'm teaching her in the only way that I can. So eventually she demanded that he marry her if she was going to keep dropping by and, you know, putting out. Somehow the state of affairs ended with Gertrude and Zelia meeting and Pierre talking them into having a threesome with him. So now, Katie, that sounds gross, right? Like that's problematic, but it kind of goes in a good direction because Gertrude and Zelia in an unlikely fashion, like become friends and they start talking without Pierre there about the way he's treating them both. And Zelia starts asking Gertrude questions like Zelia, like you would expect, you know, especially given the time, like even the day, you'd expect Zelia to be like, fuck Gertrude, fuck this lady who's like getting in between me and this guy. But Zelia's like, has he been paying you for all the work that you do teaching yoga classes? And Gertrude's like, well, no, he's not paying me. And Zelia's like, you know, that's fucked up, right? Like, you know, you should be getting paid to do this job.
I like this turn for sure. I like these two women. Good job, girls. There's part of me that's also like, what year are we at right now in the timeline?
This is like 1909, 1910.
I do like the introduction of a little threesome situation in the early 1900s in general. I'm not against it. I just don't like a man demanding it.
No, but I do like that it is a threesome that a man institutes problematically that ends in the two women becoming friends and being like, wait a second, he's not paying you for your labor? Like, whoa, we got to fucking deal with this.
Yeah, I'd watch that movie, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the story, there's some fun beats coming up. But you know what's even more fun than the romantic equivalent of unionization?
I got it this time. Is it advertisements?
It is advertisements.
It is advertisements. The romantic unionizations of products and podcasts.
That's right. We're back. So Gertrude and Zelia start talking and Gertrude realizes like
the evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild mini games. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
This is, you know, oh yeah, this is a really fucked up situation. And so she bounces. She abandons Pierre and the tantric order. And Zelia is like, you can come crash with me and my parents. And so she's like living with Zelia and her parents. I don't know what Zelia tells her parents.
Yeah.
And they're like, I'm going to guess she doesn't bring up the threesome, right?
This is my friend.
Yeah. Don't this ask is how my we know each buddy. Other. Yeah. But like Gertrude crashes there for a while. Pierre gets worried after a period of time, like that she's been absent for so long. So he sends one of his followers to talk her into returning. And he's like, you know, we need you here. We've got like some business stuff. Like this is like, especially if you want to get paid, like you got to come back and like, we got to take care of some things. So Gertrude's like, all right, well, I'll go back with you to like deal with this. Cause maybe it'll work out. But she promises Zelia, I'm going to come back. Like, I'm not going to stay there, obviously. So Gertrude leaves, and it's supposed to be just for a little while, but days go by, and Zelia starts to get worried. So she writes to Gertrude's sister in Seattle. And in the letter that Zelia writes Gertrude's sister, she kind of insinuates Gertrude might be being held against her will. Zelia doesn't really know what's going on, but she knows Pierre, she kind of knows the vibes, and she's like, I think something fucked up is going on. So Gertrude's sister travels east and like travels east with like fucking hell on her mind because she had not been happy when Gertrude had left Seattle with this guy. So she's kind of been like waiting for something fucked up right to happen. So she travels east with the intention of like fucking shit up for Pierre. She had also, it's also probably worth noting, she had been dumped by a member of the Tantric Order earlier. So she also has... Yeah. Her sister adds. So there's like, the she's got a little bit of a grudge too. Yeah. This is a messy story.
This is chaotic. Yeah.
You can make, although again, there's a pretty good like Hulu Plus, you know, absolutely, original series in this.
Absolutely.
So she and Zelia, Gertrude's sister and Zelia, go to the police with lurid stories of like dark sex magic and presumed unlawful imprisonment. And a few nights, and the police like take it seriously. And so a few nights later, you know, classes are going on at this townhouse where Pierre runs, you know, his order out of. And during classes, Zelia comes to the door of the townhouse and they have like a secret knock. So she gives the secret knock and whatever guy's at the door opens the door for her and a bunch of New York detectives rush in. And they find, you know, when they bust in, what one detective describes later as, quote, a young man clad in filmy garments and squatting as a sort of demigod among a dozen men and women strangely garbed in tight-fitting gowns of one piece, which is a very funny like old-timey description of like people in yoga outfits.
yeah
proto like early yoga outfits gen 1. So They also find, yes, squatting. They also find Gertrude, and she is dressed in a revealing swimsuit-like garment and nearly hysterical with fear. When she sees her sister, she sprints over to her and begs her, for God's sake, take me away. In his book, The Great Love continues the scene. Quote, Bernard surveyed the house and glared coldly at Zelia. So this is your revenge, he snapped. You're sore because you're jealous of Gertrude. One of the tantric women focused a menacing glare on Gertrude and began chanting ominously, Zim, 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 zee, zee, zee. Gertrude, who had been around these other women for some time, was obviously spooked. She is putting a curse on me, she screamed. In the midst of all this, someone doused the lights, but it was clear, even in the confusion and darkness, that the young man in the filmy garments was the person the police were looking for. You're under arrest, said Callahan, the detective, to Bernard. Detective Joseph Leonard, the wise guy of the two partners, pointed at the symbols on Bernard's robe. What are those things on your chest? He demanded. When Bernard filled him in, the cop replied, So that's the bunk. After his initial indignation, Bernard stood calmly before the police. He confirmed his identity and that of the quivering girl in tights, Gertrude Leo. Then the detectives rousted the entire party and moved them down the steps of the brownstone and into the spring night. The officers, the irate witnesses, the young women in bathing suits, the others hissing curses, and finally Bernard, wearing the elaborate ceremonial robe of a seventh-degree tantric priest, bearing the ancient symbols of birth, death, and regeneration. Together, they set off from the brownstone in a comical-looking parade headed for the West 68th Street police station. It's, yeah, again, great Hulu series in this whole story.
Wonderful, wonderful scene. There.
It's
I also
so funny.
Was like, I wonder if they're doing, I do know a little bit, Hatha breathing, the Ujjayi breathing.
Doing
that.
Or at least like whatever, because you know, you have to assume like whatever teaching they're getting is probably like translated through a couple of different books and language barriers. Like, but
I mean, it sounds like they're hissing or whatever. But,
some
but
variation
there is something
of that.
In there that is, and I'm just imagining everybody doing that.
Yeah. So news of the arrest quickly ripped through the city. The New York Times headline the next day read, Arrest Hindu Seer. The Herald added, Says he's a Swami. And the Tribune noted, His students in tights. Pierre was locked up and charged with abduction and accused of having inveigled and enticed Zelia. When he finally showed up in court to be arraigned, the judge asked, What is this man, a doctor? The detective responsible for the case replied, No, he's not a doctor. He's a Hindu teacher. He claims to cure people by controlling spirits. Now, Bernard did not look very much like a yogi. He is a balding, like, Irish-American dude in his 30s. He could have passed for a banker in the right clothes.
Yeah, that's what, like, the headline, Hindu whatever. Yeah. It's
Hindu,
like, no,
arrest
he's
Hindu
a,
seer.
A portly old white man.
He's like 33. But, like, yeah, he does not look... particularly mystic. Yeah. The detective added, When we got upstairs, we saw 8 elderly men and 5 women in tights and bathing costumes. They were just exercising. They were tumbling on a mat which had strange figures on it. The defendant was standing by a crystal ball and was clad in tights that came to his knees and a jersey on which there were some queer figures. So again, that's like the kind of, and that gives you an idea too of like who they're going after, because like Pierre has these young women who are like basically working as instructors, and then these old men who are presumably wealthier, who are basically paying to like hang out with a bunch of attractive young women wearing tight clothes and stretching, right? Like that is what he's offering, you know? Also,
again, it's New York City.
Yeah, it's New York City. It is interesting to me that a crystal ball is involved. I've done a number of yoga classes, none of which involved a crystal ball.
Never. Although, look, I'd show up for that class, maybe.
I'd show up for that class, yeah.
Yeah, I have different emotions around this. Well, we still have story left.
Yeah. I do wish that my yoga involved a palantir, though.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Saruman like puts out like a 60-minute yoga video.
Oh, now that would be fun.
Yeah. A little staff yoga. So bail is set at $15,000 and Bernard is sent out of the courtroom. As he's leaving, Zelia's father sprints up and shouts, That man ought to be killed and I'd do it if I could, which is, you know, solid parenting. While Pierre languished in jail, a reporter from the Evening Mail managed to secure an interview with him. Perhaps given the desperate state he was in, or perhaps just due to his exhaustion and the skill of the interviewer, Bernard was uncommonly honest. He told the journalist, "I never lived in India. The whole scheme is physical culture, that's all. Only some of those nasty-tongued women got busy. You know, if you pay more attention to one than you do to another, she gets jealous. This whole white slave business was too much. Wonder they didn't hold me for murder."
All right, Pierre.
Fucking
drag
Pierre.
This motherfucker.
Fucking Pierre. Now, you'll note that he mentions, he says that this is physical culture. That's a savvy move by him. Now, we've done a pair of episodes on Bernard McFadden, who was like the first big workout exercise guru in like American pop culture.
First, like,
right around this time.
He was like the first influencer.
Yeah. Lady. He's running a bunch of big magazines that are like, one is called Physical Culture. Mm-hmm. So what Pierre is, as he's being interviewed by this guy, he's trying to, you know, normally when he's like trying to con people into giving him money, he wants to portray himself as like this Eastern mystic who has access to like magical powers. When he's in trouble, he's like, no, I'm just like this guy who's like popular and rich and famous, right? Like, this is just another kind of physical culture, you know? It's like lifting weights. He attempts to do that only when he's in trouble, but that I think that is interesting.
Yeah, it's smart.
Yeah. Yeah. So another trend that is sweeping the nation, like physical culture is a trend that's sweeping the nation this period of time. And he's trying to tie himself into that once he's in trouble. But another trend that's sweeping the nation is a panic over the existence of what are generally referred to as white slavers. The same day that Pierre was arraigned, a 27-year-old Russian named Levinson confessed to selling young women with the aid of two. And like, he uses a word for black women that we don't anymore. Jenny Miller, Gertrude's sister, saw kind of tying in what he had done to this like white slaver panic as a savvy way to get revenge on Pierre. So she told the press that the Tantric Order was engaging in an even, quote, higher order of the white slave traffic, adding, wealthy women, women whose fortunes run high into the millions, are prime movers in this traffic.
Story gets messier and messier.
There's a little bit of like proto-QAnon stuff in here, right? Yeah. Now, the Tantric Order and yoga in general became the center of a scandalous news cycle, one that galvanized much of New York high society against the very concept of Eastern mysticism. As always happens with media frenzies, there was a period of several weeks where any newsman who could come up with a bloody-minded story about evil yoga cults could claim to be sure of a paycheck. Some of them sat down with anyone from the West Coast who would claim to have been a former member of the Tantric Order. And a lot of these people were just like lying, right? For whatever reason. But others, journalists, started digging through various Hindu texts, often like bad translations of Hindu texts that they only partly understood, looking for anything that they could like tie into this broader thing, right? That they could like, here's another, like, you know, it's journalism hasn't changed either, you know, in the intervening century or so.
I mean, all of this feels eerily familiar.
Yeah, it's very, very modern story. Yeah. In the great Love writes, quote, "Reports surfaced in the press on the most salacious details of Hindu tantric practices. A diligent New York World reporter had turned up a copy of Bernard's Vira Sadhana and published excerpts under the headline, 'Tantric's Worship Calls for Dead Bodies and Young Girls.' Since the Vira Sadhana was a compendium of abridged mystical tracts and translated Hindu writings that were long on metaphor and symbol, Oom's enemies found everything they wanted. They picked from a combination platter of yoga's alleged supernatural powers, sex rituals, phallic worship, and yes, even a mention of medieval Hindu rites that used dead bodies. When apprised by a reporter that some of the texts he'd published were salacious in nature, Bernard answered wistfully, 'That's the trouble with people. They so readily misunderstood any true conception of the system.'" And a lot of this is like, you know, that you can find like texts in pieces in the Bible, pieces in like literally every religious text that like most practitioners will say are like, well, that's a metaphor, that's not meant to be literal. Like, and also it is like, I don't know the quality of the translations he's getting, but people are finding stuff from like these medieval texts that like are fucked up sounding to modern ears. And he's kind of just like printed out in order to have something to sell. And they're accusing him of like stuff he's not doing, right? Like at the end of the day, Bernard is like a creep and probably a rapist, a sex pest. But he's not like sacrificing people or like, you know, doing rituals with dead bodies. You know, he's like a pretty pedestrian kind of creep.
No, I mean, you could also add in a grifter, maybe, or, you know, appropriating something, not understanding what he is.
He's teaching, definitely,
not teaching it at all.
Yeah, I definitely.
That, but again, not doing those things.
I'm not an expert on yoga or on Hindu mysticism, but I do not believe crystal balls feature prominently.
No, I've never heard of that.
Yeah. So a lot of it's also kind of worth noting that, again, while he is definitely a sex pest, a lot of what got him damned by the press in his day are statements that were just too pro-sex and even sometimes pro-woman for the era. One passage from the Veera Sadhana was particularly outrageous to people in 1910 New York. "Sex worship as a religion represents a stage in the development of the human mind, and the grand theologies of today are the outcome of this mode of worship. It constitutes the basis of all that is sacred, holy, and beautiful. The whole world is embodied in the woman." Now, that's heteronormative, but to most people in 2023, that's not what you'd call, like, a particularly offensive statement, even if it is a bit reductive and, you know, horny. That said, as the arraignment went on, the allegations continued to pour out. Some were likely true and some were, you know, exaggerated or just false. Zelia, who was never a full initiate, told lurid stories of blood oaths that either, you know, were exaggerated. You know, she's in kind of a heightened state when she encounters this. But I don't think anyone was, like, doing any serious, like, blood magic or whatever. But she also told stories of, like, orgies and sort of, like, sexual, like, being pressured into having group sex and stuff that definitely did happen, right?
For sure.
Yeah, things got really dark when Gertrude took the stand, though. She alleged that on September 17th, 1909, Pierre had threatened to drug her with morphine when she became what he called hysterical. She said that he kept her prisoner with his hypnotic powers. Now, obviously, I'm not like a particular believer in hypnotic powers, but I certainly believe that a mix of drugs, the mind-altering impact of cult dynamics, and good old-fashioned gaslighting can have the effect of keeping someone a prisoner without having them chained to a wall, right?
We've seen it time and time again.
It happens also, all over the world.
Accounting for the time frame that we are in as well, where, I am imagining these women being swept up in this and really not having the tools to understand or remove themselves from a situation.
No, and even if they'd had sort of, you know, in a culture that had given them more tools, this exact story, cult leaders plying followers with, like, a mix of drugs and gaslighting and sexual abuse, that happens. That's happening. There's thousands of people living that life right now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I also do not mean to suggest that, you know, people now should know better or whatever. I'm just imagining at that time being like,
it's even the harder
added element
for them
of
to
magic
process.
And, you know, and yes.
Well, and also today, if you get out of that situation today, there's infrastructure to help you, right? Even if that infrastructure is just, you can find books that people have written about going through similar experiences and the way cult dynamics work. That doesn't really exist for someone like Gertrude, you know, in 1910. She told the court, quote, "I both feared and loved him. He made me believe that he could communicate with priests of the order all over the world who would sit in council at his command and take away my mind if I did not obey him." And one of the heartbreaking dimensions about this is that in order to lay out the abuse that both women absolutely experienced, Zelia and Gertrude had to admit to having premarital sex. In Gertrude's case, this involved sex with a number of men as part of sexual rites. Some of this does sound very satanic panicky, but part of why I tend to why I believe like what they're saying is that Gertrude and Zelia, they suffered massive personal consequences for doing this. Going up in front of like a court and saying that you had sex outside of marriage in this period of time closes off opportunities for you as a woman.
Yeah. Like, this isn't something you just do.
It's something you just do today, but more consequences.
It's a big deal. It's very brave of them.
Yeah.
No, there's
It's a terrible situation for them to be put in. As the Atlanta Constitution put it in one headline, "Ruin brought to this woman by high priest," right? Like, that's the way it's being categorized. Like, she's been ruined by him, you know? The judge did decide to sustain the charges, and a grand jury later indicted Pierre on 2 counts. The newspapers started referring to him derisively as the Great Om. His followers dissolved, and the townhouse lay vacant while he languished in jail waiting for his trial. But as the weeks ticked by, his lawyers found what they called evidence against Gertrude's previously chaste character. They alleged that she had lied about her age and that she had slept with someone outside of marriage previously. Pierre's lawyer offered to produce these claims and witnesses to them in court, so the DA dropped Gertrude as a witness and a complainant, right? He dropped the charges based on Pierre's abuse of Gertrude because this lawyer was like, I found evidence that she had sex outside of marriage once. Like, that's the time
Jesus
we're in.
Yep.
He reduced bail on Pierre, but the case did go forward. At this point, though, Zelia decided that she, too, wanted off the case. Her family said that she had moved out of state. She wanted the charges. She just wanted it to end. The way her family described it is that the case had nearly driven her insane.
Yeah.
I think it was just too much for her. And once Gertrude kind of was out, it was like, I can't go through this. Like, the... just
by myself.
Yeah, yeah, it's horrible. They're both in a horrible situation. Eventually, the case folded and Pierre was released a free man. But a stain had been left on Yoga that would take decades to wash away, as Robert Love wrote in this column for Mental Floss. The next year, a Christian mystic named Evelyn Arthur C. was arrested in Chicago and charged as a white slaver. His trial was a virtual replay of the Bernard proceedings. Meanwhile, back in New York City, esoteric psychologist Dr. William Latson, who taught Hindu dancing as a way of freeing his female patients from their libidinal restraints, committed suicide in his office. Combined with Bernard's notoriety and C's conviction, the Latson scandal turned public sentiment against yoga and mysticism. Newspapers began publishing feature-length exposés blaming yoga for domestic infelicity, insanity, and death. The federal government opened official investigations against various swamis and Hindu priests. America was fascinated, horrified, and obsessed with what the Washington Post called this soul-destroying poison of the East, the tragic flood of broken homes and hearts, disgrace and suicide. Yoga had become public enemy number one.
There she goes again. Good old America.
Good old America. Now, Katie, no moral panic is stronger than the desire of upper-middle-class white people to feel connected to something that makes them different from the people they play bridge with. So Bernard was eventually able to establish several successful yoga schools. He rebuilt his cult. He became fabulously wealthy. He established a sizable compound with a herd of elephants in it, I believe somewhere in like upstate New York. It's in somewhere in the Northeast. And he worked with a number of the wealthiest people in the country at the time, including the Vanderbilt daughters. Yes, he's extremely successful. If you want to learn about this guy's whole life story, I really recommend Robert Love's The Great It's an interesting, well-written book about this fella. Yoga itself languished until the late 1950s, when enough distance from the moral panic years allowed a new generation to see it as simply a secular exercise remedy. It was still transmitted to people largely by white Americans like Richard Hittleman and Lilias Folin. Television was key to this spread. It made it easy to show people different poses in a manner that seemed straightforward and absent the trappings of mysticism that had made Pierre Bernard seem so shady. Then the 1960s hit. The hippies all started doing yoga and the New Age movement took off. And in the middle of that process, a young Indian immigrant would introduce the continent to a new version of yoga. His name was Bikram. Uh-oh. And we're going to talk about all that in part two, Katie.
Ooh, I cannot wait. Mm-hmm. I can't wait because I don't have to wait long. We're going to record it immediately.
We're gonna talk about this in like 10 minutes. Yeah.
But the rest of y'all have to wait.
You gotta wait like a day or so. Motherfuckers. Shitheads. Assholes.
That was a wild ride. Very interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm excited for the next part.
So am I. Katie, you got any pluggables to plug? Wow.
Oh, I guess so. I guess
problematic.
You know, I guess
Sophie.
I do. I guess I'd like to tell you guys about our little show called Some More News. You've heard me talk about it before. We have a channel called Some More News that our friend Cody Johnston hosts and I'm on. And we have a podcast called Even More News. You can find both of them in the same audio feed. And, you know, we're on social media and stuff like that, too. And also, I'd like to promote next week's episode of this show. Part two of this episode.
Oh, cool.
That's what I'd like to promote today.
Robert, we lost Robert.
Oh, Robert's gone. You know what, guys? That's it for us here at Behind the Bastards.
Robert has dropped off the Zoom and now we've taken control. What do we want to do with this power? I don't know.
Oh. Oh, God damn it, he's back.
Oh, Jesus
shit,
Christ.
He's back.
Oh, fuck. Oh, fuck. Are we still recording or did we end?
Well, we're ending now.
We're ending now. Oh.
Well,
we said some really horrible shit about you, and I've asked Chris to bleep all of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. That's good. That's good.
That felt appropriate. Anyways, bye, motherfuckers.
Bye, motherfuckers.
Yeah.
Behind the Bastards is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.